College is a time when students are often reflecting, thinking about what comes after graduation and what came before. From the KBIA newsroom, I'm Abby Ivory Gagne, and today we're sharing stories that have influenced the way 8 students look at the world. These Missouri School of Journalism students were pushed to reflect, write, and then share their experiences on the radio. With help from their professor, Berkeley Hudson, we're happy to bring you 8 stories from the students in their own voices. First up, Molly Olmsted. She used to have a retail job at a place that prided itself on cuteness, but Molly found meaning, not in the manufactured happiness, but in the people around her.
If you've ever been to a Build-A-Bear, you might know it's awful. I worked there one summer, and I can tell you, it is a terrible place. When I first started working there, it was kind of fun. I got to help kids express themselves. I repaired old, well-loved stuffed animals. Mostly, I worked the stuffing machine, bringing to life what were before just the empty skins. To some of the younger kids, it seemed like magic. But there's something about manufactured happiness that can quickly turn sickening. The decor was all loud colors and smiles and cutesy bear paw prints. The music was some sort of bearified pop music mixed with bearified classics. A chorus of kids sang about Frank Sinatra's New York, "If a bear can make it there, a bear can make it anywhere." Singing from the staff was also required from time to time. I found respite in restocking days, where the shelves upon shelves of limp bearskins in a decidedly more utilitarian environment seemed dark and creepy. I was thankful for any break from cute. It felt icky to sell to kids, like corporate greed taking advantage of the world's least savvy customers. These bears were expensive, $30 or $40. Their clothes added up fast. I once saw a woman who supported herself by cleaning condominiums buy over $200 worth of bears and accessories for her 2 grandkids. I went home that night hating myself. My coworkers seemed to love the place, though. Most were middle-aged women who had been in retail their whole lives, and they got genuinely excited about the new stuffed SpongeBob SquarePants. I marveled at their capacity to be ceaselessly upbeat and fiercely loyal to the franchise. I guess it didn't seem icky to them. But when you stripped away all the sugary stuff, there were real moments. People bought bears to celebrate love and channel grief. A Cajun family on vacation from Baton Rouge laughed and cried while we dressed a monkey in memory of a granddaughter they had recently lost. I once stitched up a bear with a recording of a father's voicemail. It was the last voicemail he left before he was killed in a car crash. My coworkers guided the mom through the recording process with the calm, comforting sympathy of a therapist. My coworkers, too, dealt with their own hardships, drug-addicted siblings, adult children with developmental disabilities, sick family members. Somehow, they were able to set it all aside and go around work singing. I never came around to disliking Build-A-Bear any less, but I did come to appreciate that even in the most artificially, repulsively upbeat place I could imagine, life was messy and it refused to be sanitized.
That was Molly Olmsted. Parents and their problem-solving skills can have a big impact on their kids. And Mike Tisch found that out when his dad was just trying to wash his jersey.
My dad's never been good with new technology. He's the kind of guy who calls tech support if a problem calls for anything more complicated than turn it off, turn it back on. Even with microwaves, a seemingly straightforward tool, my old man was once thrown for a loop. I was in 3rd grade and had a baseball game to play. As game time approached, my dad was finishing up a backgammon match and told me to get changed. I remember bounding up the steps 2 at a time as I began to pull off my shirt over my head. I imagined stepping up to the plate and knocking the ball out of the park. I had a good feeling about today. But when I reached my room, something was wrong. My jersey was still filthy from the game before, which did not make any sense. You see, at my mom's place, my jersey just magically became clean and was always neatly laid out on the bed waiting for me. Something had gone horribly wrong with this process at my dad's house, and my jersey was still a crumpled mess covered in dirt from yesterday's game. I thundered back down the stairs as I yelled, "Dad, Dad, my jersey's dirty." He turned around from his game. Three kids and plenty of experiences similar to this one had cost him a lot of hair, and what he had left was graying fast. The majority of his hair had moved to his chest and stomach, which jutted over the waistband of his boxers as he stood up from his seat. Cursing under his breath, he grabbed my jersey and chucked it in the washing machine. "It's gonna be fine," he said. When he took my jersey out of the washer, though, I could tell he didn't know what to do. He couldn't send me to the game in a soaked uniform, but we didn't have enough time for my jersey to dry. He thought to himself. And without another word, he threw my sopping wet jersey, not in the dryer, but in the microwave. I hardly realized what he was doing when he slammed the door shut and set the timer for 5 minutes. I was stunned. I had never seen a microwave used to dry clothes before. How lucky was I to have a dad so smart and innovative? I knew that I would never forget this day. As the microwave whirred, my dad anxiously checked the time. He went upstairs to get changed and left me sitting at the kitchen table, swinging my legs as I waited patiently for the final piece of my uniform. The microwave's beep signaled it was time to take my jersey out. My dad reached in. "Well," he said, "it's a little damp." Dampness I could have dealt with, but my jersey was no less wet than it had been when he took it out of the washer. On top of that, the radiation from the microwave had somehow made my jersey semi-transparent. Surely this was some cruel joke. Perhaps it wasn't really my jersey, but no, it really was my jersey. And my dad really did put it in the microwave in order to dry it. We rode to the baseball game in silence. I threw on a white undershirt to hide my nipples, which would have otherwise shown through my new-look jersey. Luckily, it was a hot summer day, so my jersey actually dried pretty quickly in the sun. My dad had some explaining to do after the game, but aside from that, we moved on. I was right about one thing, though. I would never forget about that day. It was the last time I have ever trusted my dad with any sort of technology.
That was Mike Tisch. College can make students feel like they have two homes, but that was something Emma Gambaro was already familiar with.
It was sensory overload. Strange, beautiful sights, smells, and sounds surrounded me. And yet, I didn't feel overwhelmed. I was oddly calm, because amid seeming chaos, I found comfort. Everybody has a place that they call home, but I believe I have two. The first is St. Louis, where my family and roots are. The second is New Orleans, the place I feel I belong and where, at the tender age of 7, I knew I was going to spend my future. I remember vividly the first step I took on the French Quarter. It was a swelteringly hot day, and I was not in the mood to be outside. However, my family enticed me to leave the cool comfort of our room with the promise of beignets, and I am forever thankful to my sweet tooth. We walked outside and boarded the streetcar just at the end of St. Charles Avenue. I remember thinking I was Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis and having to fight back the urge to sing, "Clang, clang, clang went the trolley." We were staying in an area known as the Garden District, and it was clear why. Everything around me seemed to be part of an expansive greenhouse. From the flowers that were in full bloom on enormous magnolias to the trees covered in draping webs of Spanish moss, this area was breathtaking. This botanic scene was made so much better by the addition of beautiful old houses with wraparound porches and intricate exterior moldings. My mother leaned over to me and whispered, "Could you imagine living in one of those, Em?" I responded, hopeful, "Yeah, Mom, maybe, someday." On later visits, we'd each choose and fight for our favorites, which would change over time as we discovered or rediscovered something even more special in the next block. We'd assign our houses names such as the Wedding Cake House, the Pink Palace, and the Victorian Blue Lady to aid in our debates of which of these grand homes was the best. Little did my mother know that that single question would send me on a lifelong quest to make one of those my home. There, I was truly in awe. I had never seen so many different types of people in one place. Musicians, poets, artists, palm readers, preachers, street performers, and obviously tourists, all being part of a beautiful, organized chaos. I began to let my other senses take the forefront. I could smell the salty brine of fresh seafood, the curried burn of Cajun spices, and the sweet aroma of a fried pastry. I could hear the warm, smooth sound of jazz coming from numerous unseen sources that began to lull me into a trance. The only reason I knew this place wasn't a dream was the sticky dampness of Louisiana humidity on my skin. While my initial love for this city was centered on the more touristy aspects, Bubba Gump Shrimp Co., beads hanging off magnolias like ornaments of Mardi Gras past, and the nightly ghost tours that tell stories of ghoulish pirates and witches that roam the quarter at night, I have grown to appreciate its authenticity. Each time I visit, which is nearing the double digits, I find something I like more than the last. a small restaurant named Sylvain, where I had the best meal of my life. A jazz club in Treme, where I've been able to hear the past and future of jazz music. Each of my new discoveries will be staples in my itinerary when I finally make my move. I haven't been back in over a year now, and I cannot explain how much I miss it there. But luckily, in a few short months, I will be able to officially call New Orleans my home.
That was Emma Gambaro. If you're just tuning in, this is KBIA, and we're bringing you stories from University of Missouri journalism students. Their professor, Berkeley Hudson, challenged them to share influential experiences from their lives. First dates are awkward. First dates in high school are especially awkward. Taylor Ostrowski has a story about a first date that was a little awkward and a little dangerous, too.
They say you always remember the name of your first crush. This is true. I'm going to remember Ryan's name forever because the night of our first date was also the closest I've ever come to dying. When I was a senior in high school, my friend set me up. I didn't really know the boy, but it was the name that I had said yes to. The name of the outspoken and attractive boy whose desk faced mine 7 years earlier. The night of our first date, I painted my face and put on my brand new white lace shorts. He was as dapper as my inner fifth grader remembered. But Ryan must have used up all the words allotted to him back then because he barely let out a peep all night. And after a terrible movie, we got back into his Chevy and sat in silence. Ryan finally broke the pause. "Do you want to go night kayaking?" he asked. Now, this wasn't an unusual activity in my Texas town. Most of my adolescent rebellion memories happened on the island, a fairly big plot of land in the middle of Lake Houston. What we didn't realize was because of the recent influx in rain, the current was stronger than it had been in 25 years. Paddling out, the water was getting increasingly harder to maneuver. Giving up, we tried to make it back to land, but our pursuits were in vain, and we continued to get drawn out by the gusting water. Without cell phones or flashlights, I panicked. Ryan eventually got out and tied the kayaks to his waist and started walking through the chest-deep water. Grudgingly, I jumped out of my kayak, covering my brand-new shorts in mud in the process. We battled against the water for half an hour. Ryan was about 7 feet in front of me, and I noticed a rather sharp and bumpy log drifting next to us. It switched directions and swiftly swam between. 5 feet from me, 3 feet from him, my heart stopped. "Ryan! Alligator!" I screamed as I flipped my kayak around and began swimming with all my might with the current. When I felt I couldn't swim anymore, I flipped up into my kayak, something that rarely happens on the first try. When Ryan finally catches up to me, he tries and tries to get into the safety of his boat, but with each try that fails, the panic begins to set further in. Eventually, the boat is so full of water, it begins to sink. We abandon his kayak, and he jumps into mine. The two of us floated in the dark for what seemed like hours, crammed together in a kayak designed for one. We had no way of communicating our SOS. Eventually, we saw the lights of a fishing boat, and they towed us back 5 miles to where we had originally parked. I walked back into my house over 2 hours past my curfew, soaking wet, covered in mud, and freezing cold. On the night of the worst date of my life, and incidentally, one of the best stories I have to tell.
That was Taylor Ostrowski's first and only brush with night kayaking. Birds can be an inconvenience for some. But for Dan Christian, birds have gone from mild annoyance to unrelenting troublemakers.
I've never seen Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, but I imagine it's more or less a representation of my nightmares. I didn't know I hated birds until this summer when I was staying in Brussels and traveling around Europe, exploring the great cities, trying foods, and absorbing cultures both new and vibrant to me. At first, the pigeons were just a minor nuisance. Hundreds of them lining the sidewalk, cluelessly wandering in front of my path or waddling around cafe patios. They were always in the way, so I'd kick at them a little bit. Never actually make contact with them, of course, but just shoo them away with my foot, expel them from my presence. But then one day in Paris, while I was lounging by a fountain, enjoying some French delicacy of choice, a pigeon flew directly at me. You could say he charged me, and I ducked with fear. but it appeared he relented his attack at the last moment and flew skyward to be with his bird friends. Some witnesses might say this was not an attack, but I assure you it felt like one of many, and I then began to really look at them as they stumbled along the sidewalks, their beady little eyes, their awkward gait, some of them mangled, missing a leg or a talon. After a few close examinations, I decided I permanently didn't like them, that I could not endure the macabre mental image of a whole family of them descending from the sky to insatiably peck at me, them being mainly street birds. I'd say, in fact, that I still like birds of prey, like falcons and hawks and any other bird that represents a sports team I support. They are generally regal creatures. But pigeons and crows, street birds, they have no purpose. They are scavengers and a species of hunters. They look like they carry diseases, they poop all over pedestrians, and they pester people, always begging for food or ravaging swill from the crevices of filthy cobblestone streets. They are harbingers of doom. The other day I was walking in downtown Columbia, and many birds, I assume pigeons or crows, were flying around a crane working on construction for one of the new apartment complexes. It was raining feces, and I took shelter under an anonymous balcony with my friend as we attempted to ride out the scourge. I closed my eyes and had a vision of me in the car on my way to a Bass Pro Shop, of purchasing a pellet gun, of doing a little public service. In the depths of my mind, I wondered where street birds fell on the spectrum of expendability. Surely above ants, maybe below dogs. But this relativism was not okay. It made me ask the question, what does the bird think of me? Does it see similar repulsive traits? Same awkward gait? Same disproportionate eyes? Does it get the same feeling of impending destruction at the very sight of me? Does it wonder why I, as a human, have partaken in ruining its migratory patterns? Would it like to go to a Bass Pro Shop and purchase a pellet gun to take care of the nuisances I cause? I ask all these questions, and I ponder the answers. The answer to each question is no. The bird does not think of me because the bird is a bird. Its mind is feeble, and its flocks above truly are the stuff of nightmares. Broods of winged demons touring the sky, the avian swine, the rats of the air. They ominously drift above, waiting to perform unabated chaos.
That was Dan Christian. Rebecca Hall gets a lot of questions about what it's like to be a twin, and all of those questions have pushed her to become more thoughtful when she's thinking about her brother.
Almost every time someone finds out that my brother and I are twins, their first question is, "Are you identical?" I sigh, explain that opposite-sex twins, by nature, cannot be identical, and then sit back for the inevitable follow-up question. What's it like having a twin? This is a more difficult question to answer. I've thought about it in a lot of ways. It's certainly not an easy thing to describe. After all, I've never not had a twin. But the more time I spend thinking about the answer to that question, the more I realize just how unique of an experience it is. My brother and I are very different. My mom always tells us we've had our distinct personalities ever since we journeyed out of the womb, that she could tell immediately who we were. Aaron has always been tender, much more so than I. He always wanted to be held by my parents and was a bubbly and happy baby. I was a sulking presence even then. I only wanted to be held on my own terms, I didn't like strangers, and would regularly antagonize Aaron. When we were still in our cribs, I figured out a way to open mine. I would then shuffle over to Aaron's crib, get in his, and bite him hard enough to draw blood, then be back in my own crib by the time my parents responded to his cries, looking like the face of innocence while Aaron wailed and pointed at me. Growing up, our relationship dynamic remained similar. Since our mutual childhood and adolescence, I've given a lot of thought to why we fought the way we did. Maybe it's because we were so intertwined in age, in school, and in our family. I've always valued my independence and had one foot out the door most of high school. I think this clashed with Aaron's loyalty and comfort with our hometown. And maybe he read my departure as abandonment. I feel like I spent all those years holding Aaron away at arm's length in an effort to establish my singular individual identity, failing to take into consideration that having him as a part of my identity might not be such a bad thing. Our personalities are drastically different. I'm naturally social and get my energy from being around people. Aaron is a homebody who would rather spend time with a few individuals and our family's dogs. Aaron is fiercely kind and, often as a result, incredibly sensitive. I am quick to condescend and criticize. These traits often mixed in an explosive fashion. Aaron's temper sparks easily and burns quickly. He uses up energy in a burst and then is left exhausted by the time I'm ready to argue. When Aaron and I would fight, earth-shaking, window-shattering fights, my mom would always tell me, "You'll never have a relationship like this with any other person." In the moment, I would be quick to throw this idea away in my anger. Now that it's been a few years since we've lived in the same house, I think I can look at our relationship through a kinder lens. I want to be able to give all those curious people a better answer to the question, what's it like having a twin? I think, in the end, it's pretty magical.
That was Rebecca Hall. If you're just tuning in, this is KBIA, and we're bringing you stories from University of Missouri journalism students. Their professor, Berkeley Hudson, challenged them to share influential experiences from their lives. Riley Began has a story about an unexpected lesson in conflict resolution. Riley likes to have an open door policy, and her roommates took that pretty literally.
I've lived with writers, doctors, geographers, teachers, in apartments small and old and creaky and infested with mice. I could live with anybody. I met my most interesting roommates in Paris in January of 2013. Michel was a thin, balding man in his early 60s and an elementary school principal. He was given an apartment in the austere concrete schoolhouse, as is the custom in France. He lived with his boyfriend Abder, who was a Moroccan man with warm eyes. At the time, the country's National Front Party was sowing the seeds of fear in straight white French society. So life with Michel and Abder was a politically charged adventure. People marched in the streets every few weeks against gay marriage, against Arabs like Abder. They lived their lives in defiance. Michel was an Edith Piaf impersonator, and he would ask me to hold the camera every once in a while as he sang in sequin dresses. We went to the Rocky Horror Picture Show for Abder's 44th birthday. They periodically made fun of my love of peanut butter and attributed to why I, and all Americans really, were gaining weight. Abder would try to teach me words in Arabic, and I helped him conjugate to be in English. I am, you are, we are. They would share their love, too. Their friends would come for dinner. I'd chat with them over chicken and wine and continue the conversation in the morning over coffee, and they'd stand there wrapped in Michelle's robes. One night, I came home late, after 3 a.m. Michelle and Abder usually stayed up later than me, so I wasn't surprised to see the thin sliver of light underneath the front door. The apartment had an L-shaped hallway that ended to their bedroom. I turned the corner, and there was Michelle, door flung wide open, getting really, really friendly with one of their friends. Abder was doing dishes in the kitchen. It's true when they say that you forget everything but your native language when you're angry. I shouted, "Oh my God," in English all the way to my room and slammed the door. Abder put down the dishes and followed, trying to console me by clarifying that he wasn't being cheated on. Not really my top concern at the moment. So, I'm the daughter of a therapist. I've navigated plenty of relational problems in my day, and I pride myself on being able to address things in a way that leaves everyone feeling supported and heard. But I slunk away a coward from that apartment at the crack of dawn and couldn't bring myself to face them for more than 12 hours. When I finally returned, I found them sitting side by side on their overstuffed couch, waiting, stoic. Michel had a pink feather boa wrapped around his neck. I say, "We need to talk," and they nod solemnly. "Listen, I need to feel like I can come home at night without interrupting something. It's not the sex that's the problem, it's the open door. Just privacy, guys." I was red in the face, forgot a bunch of my French that would have been useful. Eventually stuttered to a stop. They did not buy it. In the end, I couldn't convince them that it wasn't who they were sleeping with, it was the exhibitionism of it that I couldn't handle. And they couldn't convince me that it's okay to have an open-door sex policy when you have a roommate. It was my first major conflict resolution failure. Eventually, we picked up the pieces and were normal around each other again. I figured out how to swallow my pride and move along, figured out that you can't fix everything. But I can still live with just about anybody.
That was Riley Began. Jack Fleming has a story about roommates, too. But this particular roommate was uninvited and unwelcome. And, well, Jack had to kill him.
When I watched the movie Saw growing up, I always empathized with the victim. The one being forced to cut off his own foot with a hacksaw, rather than the one forcing him to. My allegiance switched, however, when a mouse invaded my room one night, initiating a 14-day battle that left me troubled, sleepless, and filled with a malevolence of which I did not know I was capable. Every night, around 4 a.m., I woke to the sound of claws scampering across a hardwood floor, bursting from shadow to shadow in search of food. I'd turn on my lamp and jump out of bed, only to see him scurry under the door, waiting until I was too exhausted to play our nightly game of hide-and-seek. I rigged traps with sharp cheddar, sunflower seeds, and peanut butter, but each time, he either stole the bait without setting off the trap or avoided it altogether. I was powerless, so the next few nights, I decided we could coexist. He could sneak around my room in the darkness, and hopefully I could just sleep through it. Ignorance is bliss. And for a bit, that worked. But as my patience grew, so did his arrogance. And amidst his midnight rummaging, I started hearing a faint bzzz, like a muted version of one of those coiled door stoppers you'd flick as a kid. Upon further investigation, I learned he was defecating all over my room. Not once, not twice, but 6, 7, 8 times in succession. Enough was enough. I stuffed the towel beneath my door and saran wrapped my vent to eliminate any possibility of his escape. When he came out that night, I leapt out of bed, bowie knife in hand, and chased him into a little hole in my closet. Then I blockaded the hole with a box anchored by a 15-pound dumbbell and waited. I am not a savage. But as our relationship grew more grotesquely intertwined, all those sleepless nights manifested themselves into a barbarism from deep within. I waited 3 days for him to starve. And on the third night, I replaced the blockade with an open box facing his hole and placed inside a trap with peanut butter. Obviously, he recognized the trap, but he only had two choices: to starve to death in the hole or to enjoy one last morsel of food before the iron bar snapped down on his neck. I wanted him to know, to fully understand, that his death was imminent and that I won. After a few hours, I checked back. He chose the peanut butter, and he lay belly up in the box like a beached whale. What does one do with the carcass of his enemy? Did Achilles let Hector lay peacefully? No, he dragged his limp body throughout the city behind a horse, and in the same way, I left the box sitting in my living room for 4 days until his body swelled and bloated like a water balloon. I buried him at exactly midnight on Halloween, in a shallow grave dug with a pie cutter. And as I dumped his body into the hole, I wasn't sure who had won. The speech I delivered to my roommates, the three other funeral goers, was one of victory. But to have my sanity so radically upended by a mouse simply looking for a midnight snack, I knew that, at least on some level, I had lost.
You just heard from Jack Fleming, Riley Began, Rebecca Hall, Dan Christian, Taylor Ostrowski, Emma Gambaro, Mike Tisch, and Molly Olmsted. They were all students in Professor Berkeley Hudson's magazine writing class at the University of Missouri this fall. To hear these commentaries again, go to kbia.org. I'm Abby Ivory Gagne. Thanks for listening.